This is a podcast for Monday, March 5th, 2012, Theories of Knowledge. There's a philosophy club meeting today, tonight actually, 7 o'clock, northwest corner of the cafeteria, discussing artificial intelligence. And today we got to do a little catch-up talking about Kierkegaard. And we kind of finished off Kierkegaard, and we need to talk about these arguments about whether belief is voluntary or not. So whether or not you have control of your beliefs. And I saw some good posts in the forum on that. And so let's just talk a little bit about this. There's two arguments in the text that you should know for the exam, for the final exam. There's the logic of belief argument.
Let's start here. I should probably use black. Shows up better.
The logic of belief argument, and can you tell me what the other one is?
The logical argument.
The what argument?
The morning knowledge.
Phenomenological. So if you break that as a long word, so if you break on the word phenomena, you know the word phenomena, you know the word logical. So phenomenological. I mean, it's having to do with the phenomena. And this actually might help you remember it. The phenomenological argument is about the way we experience. The way we experience belief, and it says we experience belief as what?
As something that happens to us, not something that we choose.
Yeah, something that happens to us. You're not. Something we do. So it says that its belief is passive instead of an active thing. And you think about when you form your beliefs. Somebody tell me like a belief that you had today. How about it is raining? Did you like open your eyes or maybe like hear rain pitter-pattering on your roof and say, "Damn it, it's rain today." Or did you say, I seem to be having some experiences of certain sounds, and I will freely choose to believe that it's raining." Right? I mean, it's kind of weird to think about, like, choosing your beliefs. I choose to believe it's raining. Well, so you don't choose to believe it's raining. You look out and you see that it's raining. You say, "Oh, okay, it's raining." It's something that just happens to you. You don't say, "Oh, I choose to believe the alarm clock's going off. And I freely choose to believe that if I press this certain button, that it'll go off. And if I press this button, it'll go on snooze and wake me up 10 minutes later. And make me 10 minutes late to class," or whatever. Right? So, you don't, day by day, you don't choose. Most of the beliefs you have aren't ones that you choose. And even what would be an example of beliefs that you would choose?
Whether someone's honest or not, like a politician, for example.
Yeah, so you're trying to figure out, is this guy lying
or not?
Well, if his lips are moving, then that's probably an easy one. It's just you automatically believe he's lying if he's a politician, regardless of party affiliation. Yeah, so I have political judgments. Are those freely chosen? Or think about it seems like, this phenomenological argument, you might say it works for sensory beliefs. And what, you might say every day, everyday beliefs, common sense beliefs. But what about pens running out? I freely choose to believe my pen's running out. I freely choose to believe that if I get another pen, it will be darker because it will have more ink in it. Right? It's like you think about all the beliefs you have during the day. My gas gauge says that I have a quarter of a tank. I freely choose to believe that I have enough to get to the LCC and back. It's you just like you know that how much gas takes based on past experience, and so it's your background beliefs are working together with your present perceptions. So it seems like let's put here background beliefs from past experience. But what about political beliefs, which are really probably moral beliefs? And I think really political beliefs are kind of a subset of moral beliefs, religious beliefs. And, I imagine since you call them Dick Santorum, you're not a big fan. Mm-hmm. So what do you think about President Obama?
I voted for him, but I can't say that I'm...
Doesn't he vote
like that? He followed through on everything that, what president has done.
Not liberal enough for you?
I mean,
he doesn't invoke this visceral reaction. I guess Dick Van Santorum,
but
you really don't like that guy, right?
No.
So, but where do those beliefs, the question is, where do those beliefs come from? I'm thinking of, so as I think about it, okay, which is worse? Someone that wants me to pay for a Georgetown Law School student's birth control, or somebody who wants to sort of preach religion at me, but is otherwise going to kind of leave me alone. Maybe, I don't know what he'd do that would sort of bother me. He might not approve of gay marriage, say. Something like that. So maybe he's like Obama. I mean, like Obama, sort of in a lot of different areas as far as Obama's not for gay marriage either. And maybe he's going to be a little more hawkish on defense. As any person in general would think about, okay, which is going to bother them more? A person who's going to force religious institutions to pay for things that violate their beliefs, or a person who is going to be preachy about religion if he gets to be president. And people are going to have different reactions, but why do those people have those different beliefs? Are those like free choices? Your political beliefs, your religious beliefs, whether you're a religious person or not, is that a choice?
Yes.
So let me ask a follow-up question. How many atheists do you think there are in Saudi Arabia?
Not too many.
Do you think that there are a lot of atheists, but they're just in a closet, or that there really aren't very many atheists there?
There really aren't probably many there.
Okay, how about this? Why is it if you look at
Let's not.
I'll try to draw a map here. It'll probably look totally unlike. Why is it when you look at
it's not too bad.
Worse.
Okay, so
there you go.
Okay. In Europe, it's just going to be a totally disaster.
Don't forget about Italy.
The boot. Right, the boot. So, why is it that if you look at this, largely Christian, the majority of people who have a religious belief tend to be Christian? And overall, very religious, U.S., pretty religious. Canada, not quite as religious, but still very polite. And then you have, well, maybe we'll try Europe. Europe, again, Christian. About Europe? More secular than the U.S. Definitely more secular than South American nations. A little more secular than the Canadians. And then you have Middle East. And then, again, I'm just sort of like Africa and India. Actually, no, let's split these here. So I'm going to try to draw land masses here. So Africa, very religious. India, very religious. And then you look at the form, what are most people in India?
Hindus.
Africa.
Muslim and some Christians. It's really mixed up.
The north, you have mostly Muslims. The south, you have Christian and indigenous traditions, we'll say animist. The sort of indigenous religions of Africa. And then the Middle East, Islam. And then I guess I'll put Asia over here. So in China, what do you got?
Are you including Judaism with Christianity? Because, I mean, I'm just curious.
Well, if you look at the purport, the numbers.
Well, it's
like.
Of course, there's land masses.
Right? I mean, you have 1.3 billion Muslims,
yeah.
Right?
Yeah, that's true.
Even in the United States, Jews are about. Like 1.5% of the population, or 2%, or something like that, and it's pretty high for the United States compared with other places.
So Asia, what, Buddhist, Shinto?
Buddhist. Shinto is Japan, so we say Asia here. So if you look at Japan, it's going to be the Shinto plus the Buddhist. Buddhism. And then in China, it's going to be Buddhism, Taoism, spelled with a T, the old timey one. I think they're starting to try to spell with a D now to be able to trend the Buddhist, Taoist, I should put Buddhism to be. What else we got? Confucianism. Now, are there any evangelical Christians in China? Yes, there's actually a large number of evangelical Christians in China. Why is that? Because China's got hundreds of millions of people. There's like a billion Chinese. I don't know what the number is. It's huge. So China's the most populous country on the planet. And so even a really small percentage of Christians in China is going to be a lot of people. So, but the question is, why is it that less than 1% of the people in China are evangelical Christians, but if you look at, say, the southern U.S., you get 30-40% of people being evangelical Christians? And why is it that in Latin America, what are people usually here?
Catholic.
And it's almost all, 90% plus. And in the U.S., it's about 25% Catholic for Christians. So, and then there's a secular, more secular people in the U.S. I think it's about 15 or 20% or something who would just say identify as secular. Where do all these patterns come from? Do they come from people making free will choices? does a person like grow up in the deep south and say, I freely choose to become a Hare Krishna?
Yes.
They put on the saffron robe and they go out there to the airport going, Hare Krishna,
it's
Krishna.
It happens like that. Sure.
But how likely is it?
I mean, it's not as probable and it's not as commonplace, but in countries where you're able to make a free will decision on what you want to leave. You know, I don't know in China whether you're really legally able to leave.
China's pretty repressive. You have to have like a state license for your church. U.S. is pretty good, but it's sort of getting that way now. People are getting harassed. Religious institutions are getting increasingly harassed as the number of secular people multiply, and you get, you know, like this Catholic university thing is the latest thing where, you know, because Catholic institutions offer health care but don't offer birth control, the state's going to force them to offer birth control and abortion and probably euthanasia and all these other things that other people enjoy as part of their government license insurance plans. But the point is, like, you look at these things and there's patterns. Why do the patterns exist? If people made free will choices with regard to their religion, wouldn't you expect a more random distribution? Wouldn't you expect there to be as many Christians as Buddhists in China, and as many Muslims as Muslims as secular people in the U.S.?
Well, it's kind of nature versus nurture kind of thing, right? If you grow up in an area where everybody's Christian, then you're more likely to, you know,
heavily influenced.
Follow the line of those traditions and ceremonies.
Yeah. Sure. So, I mean, this sort of makes you wonder about, you know, do I really choose my beliefs? And how much control do I have over my beliefs? Like, for example, there was a case in the news recently where, this is in Kenya, where either one or several women were burned alive as witches. So, do you think that people have, you know, freely say, I freely choose to believe there is such a thing as witchcraft, and that this particular woman is a witch? Why? Because the water in our well has gone bad, or because, she's seducing all the men in the village, so obviously she must have some, witchy powers or something. Right, so you think about like beliefs in witchcraft or the supernatural, and it's sort of, you know, it's a religious belief, right? It's about the supernatural. But is that something those people in Kenya say? I woke up one morning with the day after they turned 18. Well, I'm 18 years old. I'm adult. I get to freely choose my beliefs. I'll freely choose to believe in witchcraft. I bet that woman's a witch right now. Burn her, right? People don't make decisions like that. They grow up as an organic part of their culture. So so this goes to this sort of idea of whether it's an active or passive. And most people, you know, they go along with the beliefs that predominate in their culture. So if you are a religious person and you happen to grow up in the Deep South, you're probably going to be a Baptist or more likely be evangelical. If you grew up in the Northeast, you're probably going to be a Methodist or an Episcopalian or a Lutheran or one of these sort of liberal mainline churches. If you grew up in South America, if you have a religion, you're going to be Catholic. If you grew up in a very religious family, you might grow up to be very religious yourself, or you might rebel against it. And so it just depends on sort of the interactions. I think that you can make a pretty powerful argument that your beliefs are molded and affected and heavily influenced by your culture. Even these background beliefs, right, that you have every day, I mean, where do those come from? They just come from your culture too, right? Whether you believe in science, how strongly you believe in science, and even your moral beliefs, right? So in Asia, society is the most important thing, and hierarchy, and respect, and acting according to your station in life. And that's like, you have a very hierarchical society, a very collectivist society. America is more individualistic. And so in America, the individual is important, and if society has to sort of adjust to the individual. Now, you know, American society is going more of the collectivist route, you know, in the last few years. particularly in the last few years. So we're moving more towards a sort of society is more important than the individual. But in general, our history has been one of the sort of rugged individualism, and that the individual has rights that trump society's needs. But those aren't things that just sort of exist in a vacuum. Those are things that are part of our history, part of our founding fathers, part of the fact that you had Puritans coming over from the New World. Why are there a bunch of Catholics in South America? Yes, because the Spaniards were Catholic and they came over and they took over the land, right? That's why they're not worshiping Quetzalcoatl or Huitzilopochtli or any of those old Aztec gods, right? It's all Mary and her son Jesus and the saints. The same thing with the Canadians, right? You get a bunch of French people go there. They're Catholics, but they're kind of, lackadaisical Catholics, right? You get some English people there who are Church of England, but, the English aren't, by that time, weren't as religious as others. And the sorts of people that will pick up stakes and move places tend to be people that don't really put a lot of stock in tradition, in history, in family. And so you move to a new place, there's no nobility, there's no aristocracy, and you get a more free society. So, all these things. So this is I think that you can make an argument against you having much control over your beliefs. Now, you might still have some control. What kind of control might you have? So let's talk about direct control. Do you say, I choose to believe this, I choose to believe that? No, but what kind of, might you have some kind of control? No matter where you are or what society you're born into?
Oh. Yeah.
How would you exercise that control? Mm-hmm. You're trying to figure out, I want to have true beliefs. What do you do? Okay, I'm going to try real hard to believe true things. Is that thing true? I don't know. Everybody around me says it's true. Everybody around me tells me that women shouldn't be allowed to drive automobiles as I'm living in Saudi Arabia, but maybe that's not true. People in the decadent West, where women are all harlots, they say that women should be able to drive cars, but if we allow that, what will happen next? Pretty soon, the sexes will mix freely in the streets and there'll be fornication against the laws of God. I mean, that's the way you would think if you were raised in a fundamentalist culture like Saudi Arabia. So then how would you try to exercise freedom with regard to your beliefs?
I think it's having an open mind about things. I guess that would be the kind of easiest route to go. You might not agree mm-hmm. with it, but at least be able to see what other people see through their eyes, I guess would be the easiest way of going about it. And if you don't agree with it, then at least you were able to, at least see that one particular point of view.
Right, so you have a exposure to a wide variety of perspectives. Right. That's a big thing about what education's about, that you expose people for a wide variety of, in theory. In practice, it's all sort of, diversity, sustainability, privilege, power, and difference, race, class, and gender, yada, yada. And most of this, particularly in the social science department. That's what you get. But in theory, in the sort of the academy, you have people with a bunch of different viewpoints protected by academic freedom, and you get exposed to different perspectives, and then you get to choose between them. And if you're only exposed to one perspective, you're going to think a certain way. But if you're exposed to multiple perspectives, you can kind of see from different viewpoints. And then the idea is that you can sort of figure out the truth by looking at what all these different people believe. And so, if you grow up in Saudi Arabia and the only thing you've been exposed to is sort of the Wahhabi sect of Islam and all your beliefs, but if you get on the internet and you see, people in America live a different way, you might say, oh, okay, I'll compare those two perspectives. And then you get an idea that you could think in a different way. Does somebody have a question? That's a hand up. Maybe we're just stretching. So I think that also you can so
you might have indirect control. So indirect control, and in indirect control, you could choose to think critically and also keep an open mind. And maybe a third thing, so think critically, keep an open mind, and seek a wide variety of perspectives. And in the last chapter, I talked about the fact that
in academia, you're getting a pretty narrow perspective, and one that's not representative of the country as a whole or the world as a whole. And it's important to keep in mind that even though perhaps in the college curriculum you might get a wide variety of perspectives in the way things are presented, you're generally getting a pretty narrow range. And so if you keep that in mind as you go through your classes, then it sort of helps you sort of sift the wheat from the chaff and make your own decisions. If you think, oh, this is the way it is, this is what everybody believes, it's totally uncontroversial, and because, this guy's a professor, and so he must know what he's talking about, then I think you're sort of going to go through life with blinders on. And that has to do with what I say as much as what other professors might say. All right. So how about any questions about the phenomenological argument or about anything we've talked about so far?
Let's talk about the logic of belief argument.
Because
you're talking to him.
No, it's actually the way before the phenomenological, is that right?
Phenomenological argument.
Phenomenological. Right. Everything that you've written below that is an example of phenomenological.
We're all talking about the phenomenological argument.
Okay, right? Good. And then later we're going to talk about phenomenological.
We're going to talk about the logic of belief argument right now. So logic of belief argument. So this is the idea that as soon as you recognize that you have some ulterior motive for believing something, like you find it comforting, or it's sort of good for you, or you really hope that it's true, you hope that there will be a change, and you keep on hoping, and the change isn't changing, right? So, but it gives you comfort to believe that in hope and change. So, like all those things, as soon as you recognize, oh, I don't really have any objective reasons for believing this, it just sort of makes me feel warm and fuzzy inside to believe that. Then you see your confidence in those beliefs will sink down. You're like, oh, I guess I don't have any real objective reasons. I guess I'm biased. As soon as you realize you have a bias, and that the only reason you believe something is because you have a bias, a non-rational reason for believing something, your confidence in that belief typically sinks down. Yeah, did you have a comment or question?
Well, yeah, I'm not exactly understanding what objectivity entails. So if you believe something, like say, and it makes you feel better, mm-hmm. and it actually makes you do better in life, that's wouldn't that be considered an objective reason for believing it?
It's not a rational reason, but it's not. So in other words, if there's a reason you have for believing something other than you think it's true.
Well, say you do think it's true, and the reason you think it's true is because it makes you feel better in life.
But you're saying there's no scientific basis or no way to prove that it's true, just because you believe in it and it makes you feel better doesn't necessarily mean that it's not.
Yeah, okay. Well, I mean, would you think that there are lots of beliefs which aren't true, which help people get through life?
No, I think they're true.
But I'm thinking, can you think of any belief that helps people get through life which you don't think is true?
But flying that spaghetti one. Monster.
Nobody believes in the flying spaghetti monster. It's a joke about other people who believe things.
I mean, I suppose if other people believe things that help them, and they're not what I believe, maybe I would say that the objective evidence that it works for them is no less objective.
Well, but I think if you think about something working, like If you have like an Aboriginal culture and you have an eclipse, though they might do a ritual to try to get the sun to come back. And when the sun disappears, people are like, oh no, that's the end of the world, it's the apocalypse, right? And they're like, oh, the gods must be appeased. And maybe they take some poor schmo and they like carve out his heart and pull it out while it's still beating. And they say, sun god, accept our sacrifice, right? And then the sun comes back out, right? And the community says, hurrah, we're saved from the apocalypse. And then it worked for them, right? But it's not true. So, I mean, you can have things psychologically. If I think that my lucky penny keeps me safe and reminds me to cross the street every day, it might be that I like keep my hands in my pocket when I'm walking around. I feel my lucky penny and it reminds me, oh, I better look both ways before I cross the street. Well, it's not the fact that my penny is lucky or not that keeps me from getting hit. It's that I have this thing in my pocket that I associate with looking both ways before I cross the street. So there might be a lot of beliefs like this which are false, but which might sort of help people get through life. Like,
belief in God. There's no proof that, how can you prove that you're going to go to heaven if you believe in God, for example, right?
I mean, there's a question about whether belief in God could be true, but just or is true. Whether God exists or not, right? And there's, believing in God might be good for you and help you get through life, but that's not a reason to think that God actually exists. Because you can imagine God not existing and that belief helping you through life anyway.
And you're saying that belief would be less if you just believe because it helps you.
Once you realize, I don't believe in God because I have any proof, I believe in God because it's a convenient crutch, then you're like, oh, I guess my belief in God is just a crutch. And you think, well, I wonder if there really is a God. I don't have any reason to suppose there is. And then your confidence in that belief, the strength of the belief, usually will drop somewhat. Does this seem true to people or not? What do you think?
Yes. I would agree with that.
You wouldn't agree with that?
I said I would.
You would agree with it? Yeah. So I'm not saying it's going to drop down to zero or the person can't say, I'm going to ignore all these doubts and I'm going to try to whip up my belief because I feel like my belief's being threatened. And so I'm going to like attack the person who's suggested that I don't have any real reason to believe in God. But it's that your confidence drops as soon as you realize you're biased and that you don't have any truth reasons. You only have pragmatic reasons that it sort of helps you to get through the day. Yeah.
Wouldn't that mean that it's kind of like a positive thing that you're actually using your rational mind, like at that point, to say because other people are like maybe questioning or whatever, and not that it is a positive thing that it makes your belief less, but just that it makes you kind of question, like, hey, you know what I mean? Like, I'm being rational and there is evidence that, one way or the other, and I can't just blindly believe what I want to believe without questioning, some sort of like,
yeah, do you have your hand up?
Yeah, I think it removes the uncertainty factor, the belief does. And with the uncertainty factor removed, that brings confidence. So,
a little bit louder, please.
I said I think what a belief does is removes the uncertainty factor. For instance, your belief in God removes the uncertainty factor of what happens after you die, so you stop worrying about it.
Mm-hmm.
When you stop worrying about it, you're able to focus on other things that could require more attention in time. And so it's actually, I think the questioning of your belief is more the exercising of your free will, whether you can have a belief or not. And then having a question of belief, do you have the information to back up whether to still believe it or not? And that causes uncertainty. And uncertainty people don't like. So they fall back to the thing that doesn't have the uncertainty. The belief, well, I just believe it just because. Because I don't have to be uncertain about it.
And that's more like a sort of an emotion. People will fall back in emotion instead of rationality, so they'll say. And you do get like a mix of emotion and rationality. So it's like, suppose you have a woman, and she's married to a man, and they have a kind of a from her point of view, a great relationship. And then a friend comes and says, you know, I think your husband's cheating with the his secretary, right? And what might the wife do? Well, she might say, oh no, this is too terrible to bear, la 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 la, like put her fingers in her ear and say, I don't want to hear it. Or she might like attack her friend and say, how dare you say that about my husband, and you have no right, right? And sort of like say a lot of bad things to her friend to get her never to bring it up again and sort of put it out of her mind. And the idea is that she might think that it's better for her to believe a lie about the relationship and try to like sort of trick herself into believing the relationship is great and that her husband is faithful and the paragon of virtue, because facing the alternative is too terrible. So, but that's, that might be like a rational strategy, but it's not a strategy for having objective knowledge of the world. And I suppose there's a question is it in this chapter? Yeah, it's in the chapter on belief and will, as whether it's always better to believe the truth. Any thoughts on that? Is it sometimes better to believe a lie, or is it almost always or always better to believe the truth, no matter how difficult it is to bear?
I personally like to think I always have knowledge, but it's just like, if you don't know the truth and you feel an outrageously more beneficial outcome being told a lie, and you're just feeling that positive outcome, then it's like almost more beneficial to not know the truth, but then really it's not real.
Mm-hmm. So it's not real, but you have a pleasant illusion instead of harsh reality. Yeah.
Isn't that exactly the same thing that was in the very first part of the chapter about the guy in the ship, with the ship that he...
Right, Clifford and the ship owner, right.
More, like, mm-hmm. That sounds to me more like the scenario you proposed in the book, where the ship makes it safe, because is the captain any less guilty? Not at all.
What's the
owner? The action was still what like the whole thing is based on.
Remember, the owner, in the example, the owner gets off scot-free. So the question is, are there a lot of cases in life where you can be like the owner, and then you can make like unrealistic decisions on the basis of faith or just sort of sloppiness or wanting to deny reality and come out ahead in the long run, I guess, is the question. Whether it's better to believe the truth always, or whether there are some cases where it might make sense to suppress the truth because you can't. Handling.
Well, in that case, he's going to get that happy feeling when he sets the ship off to sail, as he did, because he has all these other things to back up his belief that it's going to be there. So his belief that it's going to make it still gives him the good feeling, but that doesn't make what he believed right or the truth.
Well, his belief was false, and it led to the deaths of other people, but maybe it looks like he came out pretty good.
In the example where nobody was hurt.
Well, suppose people were hurt, just not him.
Well, that's not...
Other people were hurt.
Let's try and use the example where no one was hurt, mm-hmm. and where the captain is he still considered innocent? Because nobody was hurt, but he still sent it off with this good feeling.
Right.
Because it gave him this good feeling, even though he knew the ship wasn't seaworthy. Right? Luck of the draw, it made it, nobody was hurt, but he still made that decision. Because of the feeling that it gave him.
Yeah, what Clifford would say would be, even if you got lucky that time, if you do that habitually, you're going to run into disaster eventually. Maybe not for yourself, but maybe for others. But eventually for yourself, too. I think you would think that represents a pattern of thinking that if you do it over and over again, you're going to get in trouble eventually. It's like if you're like a bank robber, right? You might get away with robbing 1, 2, 3, 4 banks. But after a while, if you're robbing the same area, eventually, they're going to get up. Somebody's going to figure out who you are, right? It's a buddy. Something's going to happen. And it's pretty rare that a bank robber is never caught. Usually they're caught after they've been doing it for a while. And the same thing with forming false beliefs or forming beliefs in a superstitious or sloppy manner. you might sort of go through life as, you know, as sort of a charmed life for a while, but in the long run, that's not a good strategy for successful living, according to Clifford. Chuck, you had a comment a while ago.
Well, I mean, it's kind of worse. It's like, if you think about how you came to be, you were born. Well, you don't want to think about how you were born. But it's true, and it's the harsh reality. And so you go through life not thinking about how you were born. Well, your parents had sex. You don't want to think about your parents having sex, but you know it's true. But you choose not to acknowledge that because it's a harsh reality.
That's a really good point. There are some things that maybe you don't want to spend a lot of time thinking about, but maybe that's, you're not really denying reality, you're just not paying attention to it. So if I think about, you know, my dog that died every day, and I'm thinking, oh, poor Mr. Puppy, and he you know, died of a massive infection, and like finding him dead, and picture that in my mind every day, I'm going to be all depressed. Or if I think about my cat dying of kidney failure, that's going to make me really depressed. And so what I do is, like, I think about, oh, the good times we have, and I see the pictures where he's healthy, and I think about that, and it makes me happy. I'm not necessarily denying reality. I acknowledge, like, the truth that my pets both died, and suffered, but I don't, like, focus on that. So there might be a difference between believing something's true versus, like, dwelling on it or focusing on it. And so, yeah, it seems like you can be rational and acknowledge certain facts of life. Life and not deny reality, but not focus on those things and try to focus on more positive things to make you feel better. And that might not be really denying reality. Yeah.
I was just gonna say, like, when we're young and whatnot, we don't like to think about death as being, it can happen to us at any time. We like to think of it as later in life going to happen, and so we don't dwell on the fact that at any moment we can lose our life. So when we're young, we like to just, like, think about life as being everything we have. We can do whatever we want, you know.
That's probably why, like, teenagers get into auto accidents all the time.
Well,
they're more likely.
Yeah.
One of the reasons, anyway. But, yeah, so, I mean, there might be a balance between, like, thinking, like, somebody tell me what's, in all likelihood, what's the most dangerous thing that everybody in this room has done today?
Driven a car,
right? About 40,000 people die in auto accidents, and you get many times that people with life crippling injuries, right? Where you could be, you know, paralyzed for the rest of your life, or lose a limb, or have brain damage, or what have you, right? But if you get behind the car, you can say, okay, I'm going to be a safe driver because driving's dangerous. But if you think 40,000 wrecks every day, and you're thinking about, you know, the latest five-car pileup in Missouri or something when it's all foggy, oh no, it's foggy, it's going to snow, you know, you're going to be paralyzed by fear. So the idea is that you're not denying reality, but you don't dwell on it. You take rational stock of it, and then you act accordingly, but you don't sort of obsess about it or think about it a lot. There might be a subtle distinction there, but I think you can make a distinction between believing something that's false or trying to trick yourself into believing that driving is perfectly safe, as opposed to saying, well, driving is a risk, it's a calculated risk, I get a lot of benefit from it, and so I'm going to rationally, you know, take that into account, try to be careful, maybe more careful than I would be if I thought driving was safe. And think about, if your belief is that driving is safe, and then you drive better after you've had a couple, you know,
okay,
you're probably going to get into an accident, and that false belief's not going to serve you. Yeah, Chuck?
Well, yeah, you could say even now that it's a false belief to say, because if you drive a car, it's possible that you could wreck. And therefore saying that you're not going to wreck, and I mean, how many people here say, well, I'm going to wreck a car? I mean, I doubt anybody would say that. But the fact of the matter is that odds say that it's very possible and that it could happen. And by that same token, that if it could happen, then it will happen, you know what I mean? And so it would be a false belief to say that you're not going to crash when, I mean, if you keep driving, it's likely that you will.
Yeah, it's sort of like the idea I'm never going to die, right?
Well, your mind is kind of constantly, like, I guess, really giving itself false beliefs.
really about everything. I mean, you know, I mean, you could drink water that could kill you, you know, or you could get sick and die anytime, or you could breathe in some toxic air or whatever. I mean, literally, you could get in, like you said, get in a car and die. Someone can hit you. It's not your fault. You know, but you have to, your mind is desensitized to those kind of things because you have to deal, if you shut yourself off from all that, you're going to be locked in a basement, you know, like avoiding the bubble. I mean,
like you said, you'll be paralyzed within
fear. Yeah, exactly. So, you know, in order to function like a regular person, you have to desensitize yourself to tons of stuff.
All right. Let's move on and talk about Hume's view on miracles. Make sure you look at intrinsic and extrinsic goods. There's this question about whether believing the truth is an intrinsic good or an extrinsic good. So an intrinsic good is something which is good just by itself. An extrinsic good is something which is good for what it can get you. And so most people think happiness is an intrinsic good. You don't think, well, why would I want to be happy? It's just most people value happiness for its own sake. But some people say, well, you know, why do I need a lot of money? Because money can't buy you happiness, right? So money is an extrinsic good. It's good for what it will get you. So the difference between something which is good, valued for its own sake, and good as a means to getting you something else. So maybe I want money. Why? So I can, you know, retire to Central America and have a villa, you know, out in a temperate climate because I like a temperate climate. I don't really care about having a lot of money, except for the fact that I need 200 grand to buy my villa and another 300 to pay for my living expenses for the next 20 years. Right. So you think about means ends. Extrinsic good is something that's a means to something else. Intrinsic good is something that's good for its own sake. So why do I want a temperate climate? Well, because having it rainy and cloudy and all the snow and cold temperatures makes me unhappy, right? Why do I want to be happy? I don't like it. Unhappiness is bad. Happiness is good. That's intrinsic good. So the question is having true beliefs, is that more of the, like, happiness? Is it more of an intrinsic good? Or is it only an extrinsic good, only good for what it gets you? If it's an extrinsic good, then you can ask the question, okay, well, suppose I have all these true beliefs, what's it going to get me? And is it really going to make me happy? Suppose happiness is my one value, I'm a hedonist. Is having true beliefs going to make me happy? Or happier? Yeah.
I think it could if your belief is to be happy. I think that if your belief is to be happy, then you can shape all your other beliefs according to what is required.
Well, it'd be more of a value, I think. Like if you say, like, suppose my value is happiness, that's the most important thing to me. Right? So it's not like I believe in happiness. It's just like I want to be happy more than anything else.
How is that different than believing it?
Believing is like thinking that something's a part of the objective world. Having a value is something being important to you, like a way that sort of guides your life. To have a value is to have a sort of policy that guides your life, like education. Suppose my value is education. Then I'm going to do things that further education. I'm maybe going to get a career in teaching, right? Or I'll spend a lot of time reading books. So I do things that serve that goal. That's my value. And all my goals are related to my values. So if my goal is happiness, if my value is happiness, then all my goals are going to be towards making myself happy, moving to a warmer climate, having lots of money, you know, being healthy, right? Why do I want to be healthy? Well, because I want to be happy, because if I'm healthier, then I'm happier. Or if happiness is my value, all of my goals are going to be directed towards making me happy. It's not really a belief, though. Belief is like, Mitt Romney is the best presidential candidate or something. Or Mitt Romney has the best chance of beating Barack Obama in the next election. Keep it neutral here. that's a belief, right? It's about, it's a prediction about the external world. South America is the continent below Central America. That's a belief. So belief is just, it's an attitude towards a proposition that says that you think it's true. A value is something that practically guides your life. So the question is, having true beliefs, is that something which is valuable for its own sake, or is it only valuable because it gets you other things? Is there something intrinsically valuable in having objective knowledge about the world, or in being in touch with objective reality? If you think about the movie The Matrix, so remember there was this guy named Cypher, and what's that?
He's eating the steak. He's like, I don't care whether or not.
Yeah, he's like, I don't care if it's real or not. It tastes delicious. Yeah, yeah. So Cypher thinks reality is overrated. I want a pleasant fantasy. And whatever makes me feel good, that's the most important thing. Whether it's true or not, I don't really give a damn. Right? So that's his view. And that's like one, that's the hedonist view. If you believe the truth is intrinsically good, you're more like Neo. You think, oh, it's wrong to believe a lie even though it's pleasant. And that whole, you know, movie is basically about the importance of knowing the truth, and that the truth can sometimes be painful and harsh, but that it's still worthwhile to know the truth, even if it's going to make your life hard. And that's, you know, it's a value judgment about whether truth is inherent, intrinsically valuable, or whether it's only instrumentally or extrinsically valuable. I want to ask you a question on the test. Is truth intrinsically valuable? But I'll ask you, like, what's the difference between intrinsic and extrinsic good? Okay. And that was one of the topics in the forum this week. Okay, Hume on religious knowledge. So Hume's talking about miracles, and you know, he's got this you know, Hume's back with his flowery language. Mm-hmm. You're thinking, oh, I kind of like that William James guy. At least he was like getting close to the 20th century and a little easier to read, or Clifford maybe. Yeah. But yeah, so. So he starts out talking about the sort of aspects of Christianity, and Christianity has a lot of miracles in it. And so as you think about the reading here, he's talking about, you look in the Bible, you see these stories about miracles, right? Jesus walking on water. He's feeding 5,000 people with a few loaves and fishes. He rises from the dead. Back in the Old Testament, Moses parts the Red Sea. What are some other miracles in the Bible?
Turn water into wine,
right?
Heal the
blind, raise the dead, right? So then, cured the lepers. Oh yeah, I was born of a virgin, right? So all these things, these are miraculous accounts. So Hume's saying, well, you know, it doesn't make any sense to believe in miracles. And he gives an argument against miracles. So what's his argument against accepting any of these things? He has an argument that you shouldn't even have to try to investigate them. You should just dismiss them all out of hand.
He says there's no exception to law of nature.
Yeah, so...
the miracles go against law.
So a miracle is a violation of the laws of nature.
Okay, and you think about this, right? What are the laws of nature? Well, you know, water doesn't turn into wine of its own accord, and people can't walk on water without some, you know, means of support.
Once you're dead, you're dead,
yeah. And you know, corpses don't come back to life. So all these are things that we observe. And you know, there's laws of cause and effect and of chemistry and biology and so on. And so, and he says, you look and just as you observe, the laws of nature have no exception.
Yeah, I was surprised that he didn't mention cause and effect when
that's what I was going to say. Isn't it putting stock into cause and effect then?
Hmm, you raise an interesting point.
Because he did, and what was it? Because he was like, I won't go any further about it. After he had said something about cause and effect, he said, I won't go in, something along the lines of, I won't go any further than that about it.
Because earlier in the same book,
yeah,
he's talking about cause and effect and seems to have a different view, maybe.
Exactly.
But let's leave that aside for just a moment. So a miracle is a violation of the laws of nature. That's just the definition of what a miracle is. It's, you know, something that happens that violates a scientific law or a law of nature. A person, Jesus floats up into the sky and disappears behind a cloud, called the Ascension. Jesus is born of a virgin. The law of nature says that sexual procreation requires both a man and a woman to conceive a child. Jesus is miraculously conceived because he is born of a virgin. By the way, the Immaculate Conception, a little minor point of Christian theology, the Immaculate Conception refers to the conception of Mary. It's a Catholic belief that Mary was born without sin in order to give birth to a sinless Savior. So the virgin birth is what you're thinking of when you're talking about Jesus. Minor point of theology. Of course, the thing is, like, how is if Mary was miraculously conceived, it had to be miraculously conceived and sinless to give birth to a sinless Savior, wouldn't her mother have to be sinless? So maybe that would have required a miraculous conception, and so on back to Eve, maybe. Okay, but side point. And he's mostly talking about the Protestant beliefs. But a miracle is a violation of the laws of nature. That's just a definition. The laws of nature have no exceptions. So it seems like ask this question: Is this intended to be analytic or synthetic? To use a phrase.
Analytic.
Or a priori, to use another distinction, or a posteriori. So in other words, this human saying, look, have you ever seen a body come back to life? Have you ever seen somebody who is blind from birth healed instantly? Of course not. Have you ever seen a person float up into the sky? No. So... Or is he saying, look, the laws of nature are the laws of nature. It's called the law because that means it has no exception. That's just what the law means, the law of gravity. Obey them. What is that? There's a bumper sticker. What does it say? Gravity, it's the law, something like that. Yeah.
But is the miracle actually just a lack of knowledge? Because you can bring people back from the dead right now. They call them defibrillators. We can give people who are blind back their eyesight, little computer chips,
okay,
and little microphone, things like that. So just because someone saw something that they were unable to accurately describe how they saw it happen, the reasons for it working, that in upon itself causes that person to think it's a miracle when it's rather just a lack of knowledge.
Right, so I mean, this is an interesting point. Like Arthur C. Clarke famously said that any sufficiently advanced technology will be indistinguishable from magic. So if you think about it, maybe if Jesus was an ET, then maybe he's using the ET technology to raise people from the dead even though they've been dead for 3 days. You might look at it that way, or it might be that Jesus had some means of doing things that we don't know about, I suppose, and that any sufficiently large description of the laws of nature would incorporate that, or could incorporate that in theory. So what we need to do is just expand our definition of what natural laws are, and there might be something that people observed back then that actually happened, and it's just we don't know how it happened, but that shouldn't make us think that it didn't happen. And that might be an argument in favor of miracles. And that would be going on this sort of
that Hume himself, there's this question about whether he means this to be, is this an appeal to our general experience, or is this the definition of laws of nature? But what do you think about that? That maybe Jesus really did rise from the dead and did all these different things, and they weren't miracles. There's some explanation, we just haven't figured it out yet.
Like advanced scientific technology or something?
Or something. Or psychic powers? Or
Did you read in the news about the lady, I think it was in China, who was dead for 6 days and then got up out of her coffin?
What?
Like, her family had an open coffin thing. They thought she was dead. She wasn't dead. Like, it was just a little news blurb on my MS and Messenger thing.
Now let me just take a poll of the class.
They only thought that she was dead for 6 days or whatever. Like, I don't understand the time period. Like I said, it was a very short news article. But they like had some friends over for an open viewing or whatever, and she was in the kitchen cooking up.
I think that clicking gets picked up on the story.
There's no saying that he had advanced technologies, he had anything going even at all. There's also the possibility of pure coincidence in many of the factors. Like, just because you saw something happen doesn't mean that you know why it happened.
See a malpractice suit.
Just take a poll of class. So you hear a story about a woman in China has been dead for 6 days and comes back to life. So who here is suspicious of that story? Okay, Lars. So the question is, why are you suspicious of it?
Going to China first.
Okay, so you come up with like, okay, it's kind of maybe like a rural area where people are less educated. What else would people say? Like,
where they control the
media. Yeah.
It reminds me of medieval house.
Medieval house.
They would put in the coffins in case they were actually really alive. They could ring a bell so the guy that was
like
digging graves could dig them out because he was actually
alive. Hold on a second. Hey, guys. One at a time, please. I'm sorry, continue.
In medieval times, people who would be unconscious for a long time, they would say, oh, you're dead, you know. So they would bury them, but they would bury them with this, like, string that they could pull if they really were not dead, that the guy who, you know, digs graves could come dig them out.
The 20th century, they still made this. Like, there's, I think the premature burial, it says some stuff on that, Edgar Allan Poe. Yeah, so... But then, in that case, and my guess about that case would be that the woman wasn't dead, but that she had some disease where she was, you know, not really dead, but had...
She wasn't actually dead. It was perceived as dead.
But then that wouldn't be a miracle, though, right?
It would seem it was a miracle until you learned the backstory. As everyone here just, like, so profoundly represented... I didn't even specifically say she was dead. I said they thought she was dead.
Right, okay.
And the entire class said that's not possible.
Oh, I thought you said she was dead. So you said she seemed to be dead. And the thing is, why do people normally go to these more sort of ordinary explanations? Because people don't wake up from the dead after 6 days. So you think... Oh, and there's also all this background information about what happens when a person dies and decomposition and, you know, and it's pretty rare that anybody's been dead for longer than 20 minutes. If you ever want to die, make sure you fall into a frozen lake because that's going to give you the best chance of coming alive. Because if you're a really low temperature, you might last for like 3 hours or longer. If you die in a hot, sticky summer in your apartment and they don't find you until Monday, it'd be impossible to bring you back. Now, if a person who died in a hot, sticky summer came back from the dead after that, that would be a miracle. And maybe they'd be a zombie or something. But that would be a violation of the laws of nature. But a person being resuscitated wouldn't be. So the question is whether it's a violation of known scientific laws. Okay, so what I mean by people don't come from the back of the dead with shorthand for, people don't come back from the dead unless they've been dead for just a few minutes and you start their heart and their brain is still good. Chuck.
Well, I mean, another explanation is that she could have been in a coma.
Right. Yeah. So
or that there's plants out there and things that you ingest that slows your heart rate down.
But why do you prefer these naturalistic explanations that don't violate the laws of nature?
Because when something happens over and over and over again, and it happens a certain way, you're conditioned to expect those things. Mm-hmm. And miracles don't happen. Miracles don't happen often enough or with consistency enough to expect them. And so you would want to explain those miracles, those things that people call miracles, with something that's a lot more plausible, that happens more often. It's something that you're more conditioned to understand.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
I thought that same conditioning was the reason why we can't rely that the sun's going to come up every day.
Okay, so going back to Hume, it seems like Hume's being a little inconsistent here.
It's like complete opposite of everything. This makes no sense.
This whole idea of the laws of nature is about cause and effect, right?
Mm-hmm. Exactly.
So that's
whose law is he going by?
His own.
It's not the law that
this is like in the same book. So it's like the earlier chapter on cause and effect and this later chapter on miracles. And so it seems like it's inconsistent with his views on cause and effect earlier on. Yeah, good observation.
Yeah, that's pretty much, I was going to say, in the light of what he said, you know, anything imaginable is possible. Maybe there's some aliens that came down and helped out the Egyptians make the pyramids. You know, they chose Jesus as their, like, cool guy that they helped him do all these miracles, but really it was just this advanced technology. And these same aliens helped this Asian woman come back with their resuscitator after 6 days. But it's really just like, yeah, it just goes along with, you can't... I like Hume's theory of, you know, anything imaginable is possible, not that the laws of nature have no exceptions, but, yeah, interesting to me. It's really, I believe that anything imaginable is possible, kind of. I'd like to, in a way.
But think about, there's that like to me, logical belief argument kicks in here. Think about, like, you ever seen, like, a stage magician like David Copperfield, right? He makes Statue of Liberty disappear. You say, wow, he made the Statue of Liberty disappear. He must have magical powers. Or you think, oh, wow, that's really a neat trick. I wonder how he did it, right? And that I wonder how he did it is basically Hume's argument, that if some guy makes a Statue of Liberty disappear, you know that objects just can't disappear like that and appear again, especially massive objects like that. Maybe a little gluon or a neutrino or something might do weird things in your little cloud chamber that you have no idea what's going on. Just trying to smash microscopic particles together and guess at with, you know, what's happening there. But when you're dealing with, like, massive objects, they don't appear and disappear. And this is what Hume's saying there. So you think it must be a trick. And that's essentially what Hume is saying about every report of a miracle. When a woman sees a Virgin Mary in a piece of toast, right? It's either a scam to get money, or it's just like some random happenstance where the image just happens to look like the Virgin Mary. And maybe she burnt the toast 100 other times for her husband, and it didn't look like the Virgin Mary. It's just the luck of the draw. So that's the Hume's argument, is that you think there's got to be a trick. Why? Because you have this idea of the laws of nature that don't have any exception. I mean, who here, going back to, like, the example of, like, Zeus, who here believes that Zeus hurls down thunderbolts from Mount Olympus? You know, probably nobody, right? Well, then you know, what the argument might be, well, why do you believe Jesus walked on water? Or, you know, that there was a magical fruit that in the garden that was in modern day Iraq that mysteriously now has disappeared. Even though when the book ended, you know, there's an angel with a flaming sword outside guarding it to keep people from coming out. You know, why believe in one story and not the other? And Hume says you shouldn't believe in either of them for the same reason, that it goes against the laws of nature. Yeah.
Everything's just sensations, and those are the sensations that are being presented. So I don't understand how he's...
Okay, Hume seems to be inconsistent here. You know, in Hume's defense, I think he might say, you can't really know, you can't really prove there's cause and effect, but you kind of think there is anyway. I mean, Hume is sort of like a proto-Kantian in that he says, if you just go on what your senses can tell you, you can't know anything. So maybe there's something more to it. So I think it might be a matter of what you can prove. as opposed to what, as a common sense person, you would believe in. Because Hume says after he goes out of his study, he believes in cause and effect just like everybody else. He just can't prove it. Here, I think he might be talking about like what really exists, and he says, look, you should have no confidence in miracles at all because your experience tells you they don't happen, and you should always be thinking, he has this greater miracle argument. The greater miracle argument is what would be a greater miracle? That somebody was possessed by an evil spirit and spoke in a language he never knew, or that somebody was making up a story, or that somebody wasn't making up a story to get attention, make a bunch of money, get the glee and happiness that comes from pulling the wool over other people's eyes, et cetera, et cetera. That somebody got carried away with a flight to fancy, that a person was mentally ill. I mean, you sort of that they were surrounded by excitable people who had superstitious beliefs which were out of touch with reality. Hume's argument is it'd be a miracle if that wasn't the case, if somebody wasn't making up a story for personal gain or because they have crazy beliefs that are out of touch with reality. That would be a real miracle that if we lived in a world full of rational people. Yeah.
So is Hume just basically saying we should question everything?
He's saying you should always look for the naturalistic explanation, which goes along with the laws of nature, and that every time you hear a report of a miracle, you should think, oh, what are some ways in which this wouldn't really be a miracle? And there's always going to be some explanation for it. And that you're never justified in thinking it was a violation of the laws of nature. And that you shouldn't put too much trust in human reports, that human beings have all sorts of motivations for making up things that aren't true, and that you're never justified in believing that something was actually a miracle. Yeah.
There was a guy, he's a really super intelligent guy, this is years ago, he offered up a reward for anyone who could prove their...
The Amazing Randy,
thank you. And so you know about him, and basically like offer a reward that for anyone who could show him, you know, quote-unquote, like telepathic abilities or a miracle or anything that defied nature and was, you know, they could prove that it wasn't some kind of like trick or...
Right.
That's essentially what Hume, you know, kind of reminds me of.
And just this last point, I think even though Hume might be inconsistent with what his own writings, I think this is a good point, that extraordinary claims require extraordinary evidence. So if something really extraordinary did happen, you're going to need a lot more support for that than you will for just something that happened that was perfectly ordinary. So if I tell you I was abducted by aliens and that's why I was out sick, you know, I called in sick and the real story is I was, you know, abducted by the Greys and you know, don't want to talk about it because, you know, they probe me and everything. You think, oh, you think,
it's,
okay,
it's
not true.
It's your chance to notify your class.
There you go, yeah. So it was very nice of them. They got internet up there in the spaceship, right? You'd be justified in not believing me. But if I told you got food poisoning from a bad Chinese place on the edge of town, you know, you'd be more likely to believe me, right? And you'd certainly believe the one explanation over the other one if you were given a choice between the two. So if you see human ally, that kind of makes a lot of sense. So we'll pick up with this next time on Wednesday.